From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It doesn't matter where you live, whether it's a metropolitan city or a small town. You could be terrorized by a serial killer. Of course, we've all seen, read about the story of Patrick Tracy Burris, the South Carolina serial killer who terrorized the Gaffney, South Carolina area and was eventually killed by police in North Carolina when they were investigating a burglary. This Harris was quite a character for sure, and I thought, why not bring Clint Van Zandt on to talk about that? Because if anyone knows these kind of crazy guys, it's Clint. Hi, Clint.
Hey, Dave. I'm not one of the crazy guys, but I've been around enough to start to rub off, unfortunately.
Yeah, I don't know. But isn't that something, eh? You know, just when you think things are starting to calm down a little bit, of course, we had nonstop Michael Jackson coverage for a while. That's another story in itself. But
that
was
nauseating to another level, but yeah, that's all right.
Exactly. Then you get this Patrick Burris nutcase, yeah, for sure. I'm glad the cops in North Carolina got him. Tell me your thoughts about this character.
Well, you know, it's as you well know, the media has just loved stories like this, and they also love to mislabel things. They they've been calling this guy a serial killer, and as you and I know, he's a spree killer.
Yeah.
Real quickly, for your audience, and I know they're educated in these ways, that a mass murderer is somebody who kills four or more people at the same place at the same time. A spree killer is someone who kills four or more people without an emotional cooling off period in between. That would be someone like, for example, Andrew Cannonan, who back in the late 90s killed a fashion designer, Gianni Versace, down in Florida, as well as four other people. So that's a spree killer. And then there's your Ted Bundy type of serial killers. They kill four or more people, but there's this emotional cooling off period that takes place. It can last days, weeks, months, years. When we look at Dennis Rader, the BTK serial killer, the number of intervals, years in between some of his crimes. So this guy, and again, the label is no big thing. As I said in some interviews, what they had to do was get this guy off the street, and I suggested that he would probably be shot and killed in a confrontation with law enforcement. This guy was a spree killer. He was on the run. He had killed five. And they're very, very likely he would have killed more had he not been stopped by these North Carolina authorities when he and a brother and sister combination that he had been doing drugs and drinking with ever since the last of the five murders. They were found breaking into a house, and finally the authorities confronted him. As you know, he got off one or more shots. He hit one deputy in the leg, and then three officers unloaded on him and KIA'd him at where he stood.
Took him out. That was the best thing.
Absolutely.
Let's get back to that term spree killer for a minute. And for the life of me, my mind is failing me. I'm thinking of the sniper here a couple of years back and the young boy that was with
him.
Yeah,
same thing. Again, more of a spree, more of a killing spree when you see someone do that. When you look at, the Virginia Tech shooting, even though there was a interval, a very short interval, as you know, the shooter there shot and killed two people in a dormitory and then moved over to a classroom building and killed 25 or 30 more students. That guy, as far as I'm concerned, was a mass murderer. He killed everybody, by and large, at the same time, at the same place. When we look at a guy like this, though, you really got to differentiate the Patrick Burris's, this guy who was killed down in North Carolina for the South Carolina string of murders, where a serial killer, normally is a little bit smarter breed of cat. This is someone who likes the game. They like to be on the run. They like to evade law enforcement. They're not looking to die. They're looking to get away. They like to kill. There's usually a psychosexual aspect to what a serial killer does, and that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a rape involved, but many times in the killer's mind, at least, there's some sexual aspect to that particular crime, where a guy like this down in the Carolinas, this is someone, his crimes probably initiated with some attempt at robbery. We know his first victim was a relatively well-to-do peach farmer, so he may have thought, and he may have gotten, for all we know, some money at that particular time. And then he moved on to these other two offenses. In one case, an 83-year-old woman and her 50-year-old daughter, he bound them up and then killed them. And you and I know, when somebody takes the time to tie a couple of people up, he's either looking to torture them or to get some type of information. If he just wants to kill them, boom, boom, and go on, be on his way again. But that suggested to me maybe he was looking to burglarize, rob, maybe he wanted something from those two women. So he spent some time. It also says somebody who's been around the criminal justice system quite a bit, because he was comfortable staying with two victims, knowing full well he had them tied up, knowing full well that he had already killed one person, and he was about to kill two more. And as we've subsequently found out, this is a guy with an arrest record that dates back to 1989, a 25-page arrest record with over 30 offenses. And in fact, he had been released, as you know, from prison in April, but he had been busted on June 12th for a misdemeanor, driving with a revoked license, made bail, and was back on the street again. So a lot of people are just amazed that somebody with a criminal record like this guy of intimidation, burglaries, robberies, blackmail, extortion, intimidating witnesses who then wouldn't testify against him, somebody with a record as long as his would have ever been out again. But you know, if you look at, for example, the state of South Carolina, you know, how many people can you put in jail?
Yeah.
South Carolina's got 37,000 people within their prison and jail system right now. I mean, you know, jurisdictions run into this all the time. They don't have enough space to lock everybody up and throw away the key. So they have them go through training and classes and everything. And evidently, Burris was a fairly good inmate on the inside at, you know, whatever he was, 6'5", 250 pounds. I'm sure nobody messed with him. Mm-hmm. But he served about 85% of a 10-year sentence. He got kicked free. And it was a very short period of time where he was out and about. But when we look at one last point real quick, when we look at somebody like this, when I saw this spree of this series of crimes, somebody asked me, well, how old a person would do that? And I said, well, you know, for me, it'd be somebody in their late 20s, early 30s. And it turned out that this guy's about 41. But what we find out many times, and as you well know, and your listeners probably too, if you have somebody who has been in jail for a lengthy period of time, when they're released, like in this guy's case, almost 10 years, many times they'll go out and start committing crimes at the energy level and at the criminal justice level of what their age was at the time they went in. In essence, for this guy, this 6, 8, 10 years that he spent in jail, it's like his criminal clock stopped, and then he got released. And even though he was 40, 41 years old, he was committing crimes like someone we'd normally expect in the early 30s because of that clock stoppage when he went to jail, when he went to prison.
Clint Van Zandt here, and we're talking about Patrick Tracy Burris. You know, getting back to that, and I agree with you, no matter how long his rap sheet is, he did his time. We could talk about bail supervision. We could talk about the system itself. But here you've got an animal like this running around in a small area, I guess. Is it a game for a guy like that to go out and start taking pot shots? Or like you say, it just one crime to the next, and he figures that if he kills the witness, that's the best thing to do. And like you say, he's on a spree.
I think he was on a spree. It was probably drug and or booze induced. when he killed his first victim, I mean, realize, this guy has been in and out of criminal justice system for 20 years. He just did almost, at least 8.5 years. He knew better than anybody knew, after he killed that first victim, that he was going away and that he would never be out again.
Right.
So he had nothing to lose, yep. Dana. And when that psychopathic personality, that sociopathic personality kicks in, and he has nothing to lose, he knows he's going to jail, his choices now are, I'll just live fast and die at this particular age. I don't think this guy necessarily had any expectation that he wouldn't be caught, that he wouldn't be confronted from law enforcement. I think, like somebody else on a drug fuel rage, he wasn't looking at the hands of the clock moving. He was just moving from offense to offense, and then he was, abusing drugs and alcohol. This guy was a match that was going to burn out very, very quickly. And there may have been something back in his mind too, that wanted a confrontation with police, that wanted a suicide by cop, that wanted to die simply because he didn't want to go to jail again. Do I know that's the case? No, the guy's dead. He's not here to tell us. But that's the type of personality that many times you and I have seen. And, I've been involved in suicide by cops, as you know, and we've killed guys like this. And when we go back and do a psychological autopsy trying to figure out why did they do something, many times that's what we come to, that this is someone who just didn't want to go back inside again, and they chose this particular way of going out of the world.
I'm going to change topics here a little bit, but we're going to stay with the same sort of psychological aspect here and talk about this Richard Shankman and the domestic violence situation and the explosives. And, that's something that, most people wouldn't even think about, let alone see in a movie. Let's talk about him.
Yeah, as most of your listeners know, this is the guy on the East Coast again, in this case of the United States, a former advertising executive who was been married for a few years to an attorney. And this was a very contentious relationship. It was spinning into a divorce. A couple of years ago, they had separated, and as part of the terms, he was supposed to turn over a beach house or a small cottage to her. And this guy burned it down at the time. And then it's the typical almost stalker type mentality, where if I can't have you, nobody's going to have you. We promise to, till death do us part, and that's the way you're going to leave me dead.
Mm-hmm.
So in this contentious divorce that was going on, this guy just spiraled down and down, and he had lost his job, and he had many, many other issues that were going on at the time. So early this week, and we didn't hear much about it, of course, because Michael Jackson's memorial service dominated the international television. Otherwise, this story would have been all over the media. But this guy takes his wife hostage, holds her up in a house. He's got something like 20 different video cameras set up around his house pointing out, in full anticipation that the police will be coming. Now, the police, of course, they see all these wires running in and out, and he talks about explosives. They're not quite sure whether these are wires for video cameras or whether these are wires for explosives, and that he may have the whole house rigged, trying to go out and take a number of officers with him. So negotiations, police arrive on the scene. As a hostage negotiator, which is part of my background in the FBI, I mean, I've been to enough of these scenes where you it almost starts running in your mind. You know how it's going to go. You know the guy's going to want to talk to the media, which he does. You know he's going to want to get some outsider there to negotiate, in this case, a priest. He tells the police he wants a priest brought there to give his wife her last rites before he kills her, and the police bring a priest there, which I find kind of interesting that they bring her to the scene. I don't know that I necessarily would have done that, but, each negotiator and police chief, he or she makes their own call. Then they engage in negotiations with this guy. He's running around inside the house firing shots. Somewhere during the afternoon and evening, either he releases her or she's able to, and I've heard conflicting stories, she's able to get out. Now he's barricaded in the house, And, of course, police now are going to put gas into the house, which they do. But here, you know, you talk about, you know, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny, how things repeat themselves. And this guy, what does he do? Well, his history is burning houses.
Mm-hmm.
So he sets the house on fire that he's in, and evidently he had set up a safe room in the basement. So he's down in the basement in the safe room. The house is burning to the ground. The law enforcement think he's dead, but they're staying back because they're afraid explosives are going to start cooking off. And here comes this guy, you know, like he's been resurrected or something, walking out of the house. But interestingly enough, he is then taken into custody. So he had every, you know, opportunity to probably do what he wanted to do, which
yep.
was die at the scene. But it's interesting, Dana, the choices that people make. They may have been fully committed to his own death at his hands or at the hands of the police. But at that last second, we never know the decision we're going to make. And we never know how strongly, like the proverbial drowning person grasping for a piece of wood as it floats by, how strong that will to survive. Even in somebody who had everything to lose, he made a decision that he was going to live. So he's alive, he's back out, but I'm sure his wife is thinking, oh my God, I may have to go through this again someday
yeah.
with this guy. So these type of scenarios, unfortunately, law enforcement sees far too much of, whether it's a boyfriend, girlfriend, a husband and wife case, where there's going to be a breakup in that relationship and one party just refuses to accept the word no. You know, another similar type scenario is this a professional football player who was just killed by his 21-year-old girlfriend
yep.
That took place here in the States. And in this case, this guy had been a wonderful quarterback for a number of years, was married with children, but was also dating this 20-year-old girl. Well, she had bought a car with him, two cars with him. She was in debt. Her roommate was moving out of the apartment, so her rent was going to double. She wanted this guy to start paying some money, and he wasn't going to do it. So now she's losing her ability to live. She has finances up the wazoo that she can't deal with, and her boyfriend suggests maybe he's going to break up with her. What does she do? She goes out and buys a handgun and comes in, shoots him a couple of times in the body, once or twice in the head, and then she pops herself. So, if, you know, these decisions, people are making these decisions all the time. Life and death, unfortunately, is a split-second decision for many.
You know, and when you look at these cases, it's a societal control, I guess, with, if I can't have you, I'm going to take you out, and then they take the coward's way out and take their own life. And we can think of case after case after case like that. But I want to ask you the question, Clint, you know, on scene as a negotiator, whether you're negotiating with Shankman or you're negotiating with someone, and you know that they're, for lack of a better term, out to lunch,
sure.
you've got to find that one little nugget of maybe sensibility that you can grasp onto when you're trying to negotiate so they can, you know, make a bond with you. How do you do that?
Yeah, you know, you really do. I always use the analogy, as you know, I taught hostage negotiations all over the U.S. and about 50 countries overseas. And I always use the analogy that a good hostage negotiator, Dana, you've got to be a fisherman. And like my son-in-law up in Boston is a wonderful fisherman. But when he goes out, I mean, he's got this, he doesn't just have a cane pole with a, you know, a cork on it and a hook and a worm and say that's it. He's got a tackle box and it's just full of various different type of lures depending on the water temperature, is he in reeds, is he in clear water, is he fishing for, you know, whatever he's out after that particular time. Well, that's the same way with a hostage negotiator. You have to have a number of different psychological lures. I mean, I had a guy inside of a bank, barricaded inside of a bank, and he had done robbery after robbery, and he was threatening to kill everybody in the bank, and he had a handgun, and one of his demands, or he would kill a hostage, he wanted an M16 and 500 rounds of ammunition. Well, you and I and your listeners know we're not going to give this guy an M16 and 500 rounds,
yeah.
But it enabled me, you know, as a military veteran and a Vietnam veteran in the Army, to say, well, you know, an M16 is a military weapon. Why would you ask for that? I said, you know, I carried one in Vietnam. And the guy says, well, I carried one in Vietnam, too.
There you go.
Well, I had. You know, there was my hook.
Yep.
We had both been in Vietnam together. We'd both been in combat. And make a very short story long, you know, in this case, I was able to develop that rapport, that psychological umbilical cord that passes between the negotiator and the hostage taker or the barricaded subject, something where you develop this commonality and, you know, good things start to pass back and forth between you. And as you well know, as a negotiator, if I've got somebody who wants to die, I have to help them find a reason to live.
Yep.
Maybe not for the next 100 years, or maybe not for the next 30 days, but for the next day or 2 days. I mean, I had one guy, and I told him that, you know, he couldn't die. He couldn't do that because he had grandchildren, and he did not have the right to allow his grandchildren to grow up not knowing who their grandfather was. Well, after pursuing that line for a while, he said, okay, what do you want me to do? I said, you know, I want you to come out. I want you to, you know, SWAT saying, all right, we want the guy out. We want him on his knees. We want his hands behind his head. We want him turned the opposite way.
Yep.
And they said, tell the guy that. And I said, oh, man, I said, I don't think he's going to buy that. And the SWAT commander said, that's the way we want to take the surrender. So I told the guy, and as, you know, you and I might think, the guy says, screw it, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to be humiliated. And I said, you're damn right. And I said, I wouldn't either. With SWAT glaring at me, I said, this is what you're going to do. I said, leave your guns in the house. I want to come out. I want your hands out, you know, left hand out, right hand out, and just stand there. And he says, will you be there? And I said, I won't be there to take the arrest. That's somebody else's job. But I said, I'll be out. You'll hear my voice. And I was able to talk him through the arrest so that I, you know, I realized my place is different than SWAT. SWAT is going to make the hands-on arrest. I'm the talker. But that's all right. We can do that together. But sometimes psychologically, right at that last second, you want to make sure you don't snatch, you know, defeat from the jaws of victory and try to force this guy into what he saw was a humiliating surrender as opposed to something that was much more, you know, psychologically palatable and that we were eventually able to get him to do. So those are the hooks, those are the lures that a negotiator has got to be taking and measuring. It's like you're taking his psychological temperature every 15 seconds, and you keep taking it because you know if something changes, you have to react to it very quickly before you lose him or lose somebody else.
One last question before I let you go. Clint Van Zandt is here. Michael Jackson. You know, it's been talked to death. I think the networks went nuts, for lack of a better term. Here's a guy, questionable ethics, legal, with children, you name it. Talented? Yes. But on a pedestal like the media is doing? No way.
Well, you know, I heard somebody on television the other day, and I was driving back from Boston, and I was flipping through a Sirius radio, satellite radio, trying to find something to listen to. And every channel, all the TV channels that I could get on Sirius radio and everything else, Michael Jackson, I mean, I wound up listening to a 1952 edition of The Lone Ranger. I mean, I was so desperate trying to find something to listen to other than Michael Jackson. And I heard, and on one of the television stations, they were discussing it, and someone was saying, well, you know, you never see such pomp and circumstance given to such an important person, except perhaps an American president or a head of state from another country.
Mm.
And thank God, one of the network anchors said, you know, wait a minute, let's stop right here.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you said, Dana, they said, you know, he was a talented guy, he made millions of bucks, but let's not start comparing him to presidents or to Gandhi or to somebody like that, you know. And the other point that I heard somebody said, well, don't bring up anything concerning child abuse or child molestation because he was found innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I find myself yelling at the radio saying, no, he wasn't found innocent.
Mm-hmm.
He was found not guilty. There's a big difference between being innocent of something and being found not guilty. In his case, he was found not guilty. So, you know, a bright guy, found ways to make money, but he, like Elvis Presley, like so many other people that were placed up on a pedestal by the media, by people and everything else, It was just, I think in his case, it was just way too much. And this guy, he had to dig a hole back into his mind and crawl back into that hole again. And in his case, perhaps the only people he could relate to on a level of innocence somewhat similar to his was a child, because I believe this guy probably had a childlike mind. And whatever he did to children, I think part of it was an attempt to relate, an attempt to have a relationship where somebody wasn't trying to get something out of him, and probably the only people who weren't doing that were young children.
Well said. Clint, thank you, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Talk to you soon.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt, retired FBI agent, security expert, author. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with criminal profiler Pat Brown here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. I'm having a little problem with Pat Brown and her cell phone, so I thought I'd go to my next guest, and I want to read this. It's an update on the Tracy Ocasio case from Blink on Crime. The Blink on Crime and contributing editors are currently working on an inside look at Ms. Ocasio's disappearance, and perhaps some of the reasons may be that the Oki police should be requesting outside assistance in this case. It's always tough to come forward and talk about police and whether or not, first of all, they're capable of handling a case. Policemen, believe me, I'm one of them, are proud, and you always hate to say, you know, I can't do it, but you got to come forward, you got to be professional and say, listen, we need some help. So I thought I'd go to one of our partner blogs and the person behind it, Blink on Crime, and bring Blink on the show, say that three times real fast, to talk about that. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening, Dean. How are you?
I'm fine. Give us an update on this case. We covered this about 3 weeks ago, I believe.
We have, and unfortunately, not a whole lot has happened in terms of traction in finding Tracy. Tracy went missing out of the Florida Taproom Bar on the early morning hours, just about after 1:30 a.m. on May 27th, with a gentleman by the name of Jimmy Hathaway. And recently, there has really not been a lot of traction. There's been a few searches. But what I'm seeing on the Blink site and on the forum side of Scared Monkeys, and also from some family members of Tracy's, a bit of a concern about the direction that the investigation is going, and even so much as to say the fact that they've excluded some folks that, in their opinion, should be, you know, taken a much more closer look at.
Well, let's talk about that. And you know,
sure.
We hate to we're not in the business of speculating here, but we're in the business of reporting and investigating, if you want to use that, and we have to look at all aspects. Let's talk about that.
Sure, absolutely. And that is really what this is about, is finding Tracy Ocasio. Her family, as you can imagine, as we've seen with so many cases, is simply devastated. They want answers, and they want their daughter home, and that's our goal, regardless of the path that takes us, or frankly, you know, whatever body of law enforcement gets us there, what have you. One of the there's a couple of things going on. It's a very complex case, and sometimes it does lend itself to taking a little bit longer, and you know, in terms of interviewing people. But the components of the case, as it relates to Tracy specifically, is on the evening of April 14th into the 15th, Tracy was at the tap room with her girlfriend and then a gentleman, and got into an altercation with a group of folks over the pool table. And this is by her own admission from a forum that she had belonged to, where she posted the evening that she got back. She had some words with a blonde-haired woman who we believe is a woman by the name of Lori Branchick, and was with the Hutto brothers, which is Jeremiah and Paul Hutto.
Mm-hmm.
They go outside where they get into a bit of a more physical altercation, in which Paul Hutto pushes Tracy to the ground during an argument. She jumps up. I think she says she smacked him and spit on her or something to that effect. But Paul Hutto was arrested that night. Paul Hutto is a very close friend and associate and business co-worker of Jimmy Hathaway's. Now, Jimmy Hathaway was not there that evening. So he was not involved in this whatsoever. He was aware of it, but Paul Hutto was arrested. He spent the night in jail. And when I went to investigate this further, I was unable to obtain a copy of the police report, the incident report for that evening, which is very rare.
How come?
Well, I was told that it's in the hands of the state's attorney's office. I was able to confirm through Orlando PD that he was, in fact, arrested on a battery charge that was lodged by Ms. Ocasio, but that it was withholding with the state's attorney's office, and they would be making the decision as to whether or not that would be available to the public. Now, keep in mind, there is no charges filed. So I have not seen that before, and I'm giving you all the information that I had been given. But moreover, therefore, you have Mr. Hutto and his brother, and frankly, several members of his family have fairly extensive criminal records. And when I say extensive, I mean going back a long time, but also there's a long line of delineation of what I would call fairly serious felony charges up front that have been pled down in ways I haven't seen very often. An example would be Paul Hutto with a sexual battery two counts charge that was pled down to a misdemeanor battery. No time served. I think I think Jeremiah, his brother, had similar charges and ended up serving a month. Several charges where they declined to prosecute. And what I'm hearing from relatives and some friends on the street is that Paul Hutto is what we call a confidential informant. I was able to confirm that with some, you know, when you get into these cases, Dana, not a lot of people offer that information.
I understand.
But I can tell you that I was able to verify that within those circles, that's a true statement. And the concern is that Paul Hutto has been leading law enforcement around early on in areas where he felt potentially she might be. With pending charges and, you know, the situation with Tracy being what it was, I think there's a genuine level of frustration as to why this group of folks, their homes have not been searched. Moreover, on the 27th, we had just uncovered the Ocoee Police Department's dispatch calls and police calls about 2 or 3 days ago. The day that she was reported missing, at about 6:04 p.m., there was a 911 call from the Hutto home on Wyoming Court, which I covered exclusively on Blink on Crime, that was a hang-up in close proximity to a shots fired with about a mile away. To another close associate of the Hutto brothers, which I think is pretty compelling.
Yep.
In a case where you have a missing person, a known associate with pending charges, and I was also able to today interview somebody that I've been trying to get a hold of for quite some time. If you look at the circle of friends and associates of Jimmy Hathaway, there is an individual that is really considered a brother to Jimmy, and he shed some light on a couple of issues. The Rachel Clark incident that Jimmy is currently in Seminole County Jail charged with battery, I think aggravated battery and burglary, happened last August. And what he told me was rather shocking in that this gentleman, I'm going to withhold his name, he was actually handcuffed the night of this incident because they thought he was Jimmy. And when they figured out he wasn't Jimmy, Jimmy Hathaway has never been interviewed. The state's attorney's office and police never followed up back up with Jimmy to interview him personally on this incident. So essentially, he's been arrested on these charges, but he's never been questioned whatsoever in almost a year.
Wow. What are the Ocoee cops saying?
They're not really saying anything. They said a lot in the beginning. They so much as gave he gave a voluntary DNA sample. They so much as put that out through CODIS, saying although he was not a suspect in any unsolved crime in the state of Florida, they were going to kind of field it out there and see if maybe in the future if there was a jurisdictional issue that they would have to deal with. And I've never heard that.
That's crazy.
Yeah, well, right. You know, we don't think he's guilty of anything here, but we're going to put it in the queue. So I have to say, when I look at the properties that the Hutos have, and I'm not making an allegation, I'm suggesting that in our efforts to find a missing person, we really have to, if what we're focusing on in a narrow way is not producing results, we have to widen that berth. We have to look at other areas. And I think the Hutos story, their associates, what I'm hearing on the ground is very compelling.
Well, the big story is, and I think the big part of this is, and this is me saying this, is law enforcement, if you make a mistake, come forward and say it. Put your egos aside, and if you need help, ask for it. And the goal here is to find this gal and to build a proper case and to do a proper investigation.
Right. And I am a staunch supporter of law enforcement, as you know. I've worked with them on other cases. I've worked with them in the Kaylee Anthony case.
Yes.
And that, to me, if you look at the multi-jurisdictional success that has occurred, and I'll temper it by saying success will end with a successful prosecution, but saying for now, I don't think there's anything like it, and I'd love to see that mirrored in a jurisdiction that's got a much smaller resource pool, if nothing else.
Yep.
You know, I think sometimes there tends to get some ownership, and I respect that, and I think there's some value in that, but I also think the priority is preserving evidence and certainly finding Tracy, and that's where the goal needs to be.
Well said. The blog is Blake on Crime. Follow the case there. Thanks for joining us, and we'll stay in touch.
Thanks, Dean. Have a good evening.
Okay, bye-bye. You know, we've said it before about other law enforcement, and we'll say it again. Hey, I am one. We support them 1,000%, but if you need help, ask for it. If you made a mistake, admit it, and let's get on with life. We're going to take a break, and Pat Brown's fixed her phone. We'll have her back here in just a minute on Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. I would introduce her as the late Pat Brown, but she is alive and well. She had a phone problem, but she's here. You'll know her as criminal profiler Pat Brown. She's a regular on Nancy Grace Show, and she drops in on our program every so often. Good evening, ma'am. How are you?
I'm good.
How are you coping after the death of Michael Jackson? I know I can hardly stand it. I haven't slept most nights here.
Yeah.
You know, and the great, I'm waiting to see his face etched on the side of Mount Rushmore. You know what, Pat? I'm absolutely sick of it. The guy was talented. Yeah, he sold millions or billions of records. I don't give a damn. But he also had his problems, too. What's wrong with the media and what's wrong with society?
Well, I see there's something in people that likes to remember good. They like to remember things that are exciting and fantastic. And they're able to basically hone in on those and ignore the other parts of the person. I find that a little disconcerting because some people said we could say that about a lot of people, not quite so good people, well, just because they have some traits that are admirable here and there. I think we could separate that nicely. I think we could say, as I would feel about Michael Jackson, yes, he was a fine entertainer, and he did do some fine, good dancing and some excellent singing, and I appreciated that aspect of him. But having more concerns about his other behaviors, and having watched the Bashir interviews, remember the one when he went on Michael Jackson and interviewed him in his home and asked him tons of questions? Those were the creepiest. Oh, that was just very, very concerning. I remember watching the part where he asked Michael Jackson about his face surgeries and his nose surgeries, and I guess people counted there probably about 13 of them. And Michael Jackson was able to look straight at him and bold-faced lie about it, say, I only had one, and it was just so I could breathe better. And everybody's attacking me. I think it's horrible and cruel. And what was me? I thought, wow, you're a pathological liar here. And he lied about so many other things during the interview that was just absolutely made my skin, it was just I don't know, I watched his behaviors and I said to myself, this is not a person I particularly like. This is a person I wouldn't trust when much of anything, including my children. And yes, I might hire him to sing. I might do that because he is a fine singer. But I would keep it in a business sense, and I would not particularly think to myself, this is a person I want to get to know or have any faith in or have any trust in. I found his behavior rather concerning.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of people hear this term narcissist or sociopath or pathological liar. What's the difference in the three?
Well, I think it's a continuum, actually. Narcissism, we all have a bit of that in ourselves. Some of it's self-protective. We have to care about ourselves. But when we get to the point we care about ourselves without caring about anybody else, where nobody else matters but us, and we see the world only through our eyes and never able to take a look at the way other people would see it, step into their shoes and say, wow, I can understand where you're coming from, or I can have sympathy for you, or I can see why you think that of me. My behaviors, I see, have hurt you, and that bothers me that you're in pain. Not just bothers me because I got caught and I have to deal with it, but bothers me because you are in pain. That is a healthy person. When a person gets to a higher level of narcissism, they stop thinking about other people as having any meaning except as pawns in their own game. This is what I see in Michael Jackson. Through all his interviews, it was about me, it was about me, it was about me. The pain I've suffered, the things I've had to go through, the tragedies, in my life, the way people think of me, woe is me, I'm thinking, wow, you know, compared to a lot of people in the world, Michael, you've had a tremendous amount of advantages. Okay, your childhood wasn't perfect, and you had a lot of pressures on you. But look how much money you make, and look how you're adored.
Yeah.
I hardly think that's the worst life in the world. So if somebody thinks a certain way about you, so if somebody has accused you of having plastic surgery, big deal. I mean, you're a famous person. You would expect a few people are going to say a few negative things about you and even lie about you. But it doesn't mean you have to sit there and cry over it.
Yeah.
Because you wanted to be in the limelight. You're getting the benefits of being in the limelight, so you should be able to buck up a little bit and say, well, that's what happens sometimes. Sometimes people are jealous, and sometimes people don't like everything about me. So what?
Yeah.
I can live with that. I understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
And he could smile and say, yes, I've had a few surgeries. I'm just one of those weird people. But no, he lied about it. And he was very much angry that anybody dared to say anything negative about him. So I would say he's pretty high on the narcissism chart.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that's the nonstop 24/7 coverage, in fact, it continues today, of Michael Jackson was the lack of reporting on some other stories. We heard a little bit about Patrick Tracy Burris and the story of him in South Carolina and then getting killed in North Carolina, but then that ended real quick. We didn't find the whole story. Was Burris a serial killer as reported, or is he just a guy out on a spree?
He's a guy out on a spree, and I've seen the serial killer term given on almost every channel, every show, every newspaper, and I keep going, no, he's a spree killer, not a serial killer. And there is a huge difference between the two, and it makes a difference in investigations as far as how you conduct an investigation, what you can expect how it's going to go. With a serial killer, you have no clue who it is. He's trying to be sneaky. He's committing his crime, and he's slithering back into society, and he doesn't want to get caught because he wants to be able to do this again and again over the years. He's enjoying himself. So when the police have that kind of person, they have a very difficult time ever trying to catch him. They have to go out to the public and give as much information as possible so people can identify some peculiar guy that they know or they know something about so they can hone in on a suspect. In this particular case, since this guy was a spree killer, a spree killer is nothing but a mass murderer in slow motion who is planning to die at the end of the day. He just takes a little bit longer than a mass murderer. I think what happened to him was he got out of prison. He's been a lifelong felon. And he was going to go for the straight life, but that lasted about a day when he realized the straight life was boring. He didn't like it. And he probably started in on one of his crime events. And I don't know if something went wrong during one of them. I don't know if he killed on purpose the first time or whether he got angry and shot somebody and then said, oh, great. Now I'm done now. They're going to come and get me and they're going to put me back in prison. And I'm not going to let them do that. And so that's what started the actual spree. And then he decided he'd just keep doing whatever he did until they got him.
And they did. And justice was served in North Carolina. Pat Brown, thank you.
No, thank you.
We'll talk soon.
Alrighty.
Bye-bye. That's Pat Brown, criminal profiler. We're going to be back in just a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio with our weekly Sax Facts. No, that's not it. It's called Nothing But the Sax with ADA out of Los Angeles County, Robin Sax, her weekly segment here. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and it's our weekly segment with Robin Sax called Nothing But the Sax. She's an ADA out of Los Angeles County, an author. She does it all, and she's always welcome on the program. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. Last week, you and I and Wendy Murphy talked about Michael Jackson. We're still talking about Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson, Michael Jackson. It's absolutely getting sickening. Some are saying that he deserves a stamp and we should have a National Day of Remembrance for Michael Jackson. Really, when it comes right down to it, he was a good entertainer. He sold millions of records, but there's another side. We all have them. Some say skeletons in our closets, but has the media gone absolutely nuts with this?
Well, it's so fascinating to see, and I just recall our conversation in email form, how you and I normally communicate just following the news of Michael Jackson's death, you know, just over a couple weeks ago now. And, you know, all from the moment we heard all of a sudden that the, the past, the accusations, the lawsuits, the alleged sexual molestation, which even now I say alleged, and all kinds of other dirty things, as you're, you know, aptly calling the skeleton in the closet, seem to have, you know, died with Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
And lucky for him, you know, good for him, because that's amazing that your legacy can be so fantastic that some of the most horrific accusations, some of the most heinous crimes can literally go unforgotten. The thing that's most troubling to me is I've had a close family member suggest that I shut my mouth during this time of remembrance and exultance and putting Michael Jackson on a pedestal and so forth. And I think about that, and I think about, you know, he was a fantastic musician. He was an amazing entertainer. It was a, you know, sad tale on a lot of ends. But it does not change the fact that some of his legacy for some people who actually care about children and for some people who actually care about justice can look at Michael Jackson's cases that had or tried, or case that was tried in Santa Barbara and then the case that never got tried here, as some of the examples of the downfalls of the criminal justice system, and can't help but to remember that there is a taint that was based on some rational.
You know, the big part that bothers me, and we've talked about Jackson many times, I've had many guests talking about Jackson, and a lot of it alleged, yes, there's this whole... he was found innocent. I hear the media saying you're never found innocent in court. You're found not guilty. There's a difference in the two. And I want to touch on that for a second, and then I'm going to get into my blast on the media.
Okay. No, that's absolutely so important. Yes. The standard of proof in the state of California and all of the United States is that the prosecution, I mean, the people... the prosecutor, myself, would have the burden of proof of proving a defendant guilty of the crimes. And that means not just some of the elements, but each and every element of a crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Beyond a reasonable doubt, you'll even hear defense attorney, I'm sure, as you've seen in court, your skin crawling like mine when they're talking about how impossible it is ever to get to reasonable doubt. And it is an extremely high standard in the legal system. It's the highest standard of proof. It's higher than that which would make people lose their parenting rights. It would be higher than that for being responsible for millions and millions of dollars. It is the biggest and most highest standard. And not proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt is very different than a finding of innocence. As a matter of fact, if there wanted to be a finding of innocence, Michael Jackson could have filed with the court, and California would have the ability, a motion for the court to find factual innocence, meaning that there could not have been even a trial. There was not even any doubt at that point. And you didn't see Michael Jackson ever file those documents. And that's because the allegations were based on some truth. The settlement that happened in California and Los Angeles prior, that was my office that handled that case, and I'm pretty confident that that civil settlement was not done as just a shakedown for money, but in fact that there was some basis to the claim.
Absolutely. Robin Sachs is here with our weekly Nothing But the Sachs segment. The media, Robin, and you do a radio show, Justice Interrupted, Tuesday nights. By the way, you gals have been kicking proverbial butt here the last few weeks, been doing a great job. But the media has gone absolutely nuts with this. But what they're also doing is they're ignoring cases. We were talking tonight about Burris, the spree killer. Although the media has labeled him a serial killer, he's more of a spree killer. The husband that took his wife hostage had all the explosives. There's all sorts of stories, but it was nonstop Jackson coverage. How many times do we have to hear about these doctors? And yes, it's important, don't get me wrong, to find out why he died and if there's any complicity with the medical profession, then somebody needs to answer to this. But the media went absolutely nuts, and really, it shows like yours and mine and a few others. Even Nancy Grace was nonstop Michael Jackson for a while. Why? What, do you think that the people really care that much?
I've had it up to my ears, I knew that it was going to be a story that was going to last, but, I mean, you know, when you go to the Beverly Wilshire and the bar, and when they don't have the sporting events on anymore, and now we're watching CNN and headline news because of Michael Jackson, I felt like this was like the O.J. chase all over again, except for the fact that Michael Jackson is dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're sitting here watching the same clips, the same highlights of the same, you know, performances, the same commentary. There is nothing new. And so I'm happy to get, you know, satiate the public with information. But let's give them something that's informative and information. And I think there are so many cases that could deserve, you know, a tenth, a half of a tenth, you know, a percentage point of attention that Michael Jackson has done, and we wouldn't be doing some good. So to me, this is ridiculous. And I know that I know what the media's response to it would be: announce the ratings. People want this, but I mean, for me not to watch television. Because I'm pretty much a news hog.
Let's finish up with what you've been doing lately on Justice Interrupted.
You know, this last week in Justice Interrupted, we had a fantastic lineup of guests. We had one of our new contributors to Women in Crime. We actually had two people from Women in Crime, Inc., which is our sister blog of sister crime authors, which is available at Women in Crime, Inc., I-N-K, as in Inc., like Pen Inc., .blogspot.com. And so we had Kathy Scott, who actually wrote the Biggie Biggs story, the Notorious B.I.G. story, and then also did the story about Tupac Shakur, which was really interesting, talking about gang crime. We also had Diane Fanning talking about some of her books, and also Casey Anthony book that she's writing that's due out. And then we had one other guest that I was not on the phone for, and you'll have to excuse my senior moments or my fried California brain for not recalling who that was. And next week, I'm hoping to have Convince Red, who is your wonderful producers over there and founders of Scared Monkeys and of course, a regular commentator, at least from a writing point of view, who has always a breath of fresh air to share with us. So I'm hoping to con him into joining us next week.
I think I've heard of him. Anyway, that's nothing but the Sacks for this week. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye. That's it. That's tonight's show. We'll see you again real soon here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Remember, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.